From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
A federal judge will now decide the fate of Illinois' assault weapons ban. Testimony was heard in court this week, and we'll discuss that and the challenge to it. Also, the state marked 1 year since the elimination of cash bail. That's some of the things we'll talk about on this episode of State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And our guest from Capital News Illinois, good to welcome back Peter Hancock. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
It's good to be here.
So, Peter, you spent the week in the federal courthouse in East St. Louis where this challenge was being heard. So let's talk about that, and let's first talk about what the state has done here and why this challenge was brought forward.
Okay, so in January of 2023, the Illinois General Assembly had a special lame duck session, and they passed a law banning an entire class of weapons that it defines as assault-style weapons, as well as large-capacity magazines and certain kinds of ammunition. This was in response to the large number of mass shootings that have occurred in the United States by gunmen who used these weapons to take out large numbers of people in a very short period of time, often from a long distance. The most notable and the most recent at that time was the Independence Day parade massacre in Highland Park, that I think seven people lost their lives and dozens of people were either injured or severely traumatized by the event. And so I think Illinois was maybe the 10th state at that time to pass a law banning these kinds of weapons. But for whatever reason, the challenges to it under the Second Amendment have proceeded faster than they have in other places. So this actually got to the Supreme Court late last year, earlier this year, and the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to review this until after the lower courts have had full trials and reached their verdicts on this. The question was whether or not they would issue a preliminary injunction to block enforcement of it. So it was remanded back to the lower courts, and this is the first trial to get underway since then. And there are like four cases here that have been consolidated, various individuals, gun store owners, and gun rights organizations are challenging this under the Second Amendment of the Constitution. And there are really two questions that the court is addressing. One is whether or not the weapons that are banned are in common use in the United States. Are they commonly used weapons that are used for legitimate purposes like self-defense? That comes out of a Supreme Court case from 2008 called District of Columbia versus Heller, the Heller decision. And then the second question is whether or not there is a historical tradition in the United States dating back to the founding of the Constitution, a tradition of regulating these types of weapons. What we heard over the last 4 days was live testimony addressing the first question, whether or not these are commonly used, whether these weapons are in common use in the United States and they're used for legitimate purposes like self-defense. The state is arguing, no, these are not self-defense weapons. These are militaristic assault weapons. They are intended to be used in the offense to take out large numbers of people in a short period of time. The defense put on, or the plaintiffs put on, expert witnesses who said, no, these, you know, there are millions of these things in circulation, and people do in fact use them for self-defense. So that's the question that was addressed in the live trial. The other question about whether or not there is a historical tradition of regulating these types of weapons is all going to be addressed in briefs and exhibits. It's all being argued on paper. So we really haven't seen that side of the argument yet. So it's going to be a number of weeks before the court gets around to rendering a full decision here.
And I was going to ask you that because I certainly followed state courts through the years, but I'm a little unclear when it comes to federal courts how long that tends to go. Is it about the same? I mean, just whenever the verdict, whenever the ruling is finished, the judge will announce it?
Yeah, pretty much, especially in a bench trial like this. There was no jury. This is all going to be decided by the judge, Stephen McGlynn, who's a longtime St. Clair County person with a lot of legal experience. It's going to be decided by him, and the decision comes when the decision comes. I mean, that's always been my rule of thumb when you're dealing with court decisions. But one thing that we were told during the course of the trial was that once, you know, this part of the trial ends, the lawyers have 30 days in which to submit what's called their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. Basically, the lawyers sit down and write the opinion that they would like the judge to issue. And then the judge will go through those, depending on which way he decides. He will likely, you know, use that document as sort of the basis of the opinion that he puts out.
Well, Charlie, we knew the minute this was passed, even when it was just being talked about, that once it did take effect, it was going to wind up going through the court system, and it won't be done once the East St. Louis judge there makes his determination, because like Peter had indicated, this is likely going to wind up at the U.S. Supreme Court. They'll have to decide whether or not they want to take up the case, and that could take a while longer. So it'll be 2 years come January since they approved it, and it looks like a lot longer before we have a final decision, I guess.
Yeah, I think that is accurate. One of the things that Peter had in his story that I thought was interesting was the judge seemed to sort of, I don't know, like suggest how he's leaning on this. And this case is being heard in East St. Louis. And the federal judge, Stephen McGlynn, mentioned how there was in 1917, there was a race riot in East St. Louis where a white mob attacked the city's black population with numerous people killed. And so the judge says, and I'm going to quote him from Peter's story, "The official death toll was 39, but no one believes that." And the judge said the true death toll was probably in the hundreds. But then what he said, and what piqued my curiosity, he said, I wonder what would have happened if they, meaning the black population, had some of the weapons we're talking about today. And so that suggested to me that maybe the judge was thinking, well, these are weapons of self-defense, and there's sort of a history saying that had these been available at that time to these folks who were attacked and murdered, they maybe would have been able to defend themselves. So I thought that was an interesting angle. But like you said, this is going to take a while, and it's going to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I would be willing to bet that if they take the case, which they probably will, depending on what the lower court ruling is, that they will throw out the state's assault weapons ban and say that, no, these are commonly used, and there's a tradition of them being used, and the founding fathers did not intend to ban automatic weapons. Now, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not sure if back in the 1700s they really had these kind of automatic weapons that we have today, but that's the way it goes.
Well, Peter, you mentioned whether or not or how widely used these are, and I know some people who have had these and may still have them to do things like target shooting, things like that, not just for self-defense, but it does seem they are pretty common from at least some of the testimony that you reported on from the gun store owners, for example. Is that correct?
Yeah, they are common now. And one of the points that came up during the trial was, you know, there was for a period of time a ban, a federal ban on assault weapons from like 1994 through 2014. It was in place for like 20 years. And at that time, these kinds of weapons were fairly rare. It was only after the expiration of the federal assault weapons ban that gun manufacturers came out with these AR-style, you know, whole lines of AR-style weapons and marketed them to the mass public once the federal assault weapons ban expired. And I think one of the points that the state is trying to make is that the question of whether or not a weapon is protected under the Second Amendment by this standard, you know, is it in common use for legitimate purposes, is that gun manufacturers' marketing strategies should not determine what the Constitution does and does not cover. I mean, the only reason why these things are in mass circulation right now is that gun manufacturers have put them out there during a period after federal regulation of them had expired. Prior to that, they were fairly rare. So do gun manufacturers get to decide what the Constitution does and does not cover simply by adopting different marketing strategies? So that's the argument that the state is going to be making on that issue. But yeah, I mean, the reality is right now there are, in fact, millions of these things out there in circulation. Whether or not people are using them for self-defense, you know, I think statistically you can argue one way or another. But I thought another interesting part of this trial was that all of the testimony that we heard was like engineering testimony. It was all about the scientific and mechanical operations of weapons and different kinds of trigger mechanisms and firing mechanisms and, you know, what types of alloys are used in the barrels. I mean, it was all very scientific information that had nothing to do with the human beings who have died from the other end, you know, being on the other end of these guns. There was little discussion during that trial of the mass shootings that have occurred and, you know, how these weapons are used other than self-defense. So whether or not the judge takes that into account, we don't know yet. Maybe the lawyers will make a bigger point of that in the briefs and the exhibits as they go on, you know, to argue the other part of the case.
And Charlie, just to show how hard it's been for the state to enforce something like this, of course, the people who have these are being grandfathered in, but they're supposed to register them. And that, from the last reporting I've seen on it, has not been going swimmingly. Not a lot of people are doing that. So does the state really doesn't have an idea how many of these are actually in the hands of the public at this point, I guess, because so many people have decided not to let the state police know.
Yeah, and I think part of it also is that any number of sheriffs said at the time that we don't agree with this. And so, Charlie Wheeler, if you have one of these weapons and you don't register it, that's okay by us. We're not going to come after you. We're not going to take your weapon away. So there really isn't any good count other than what some of the gun shop owners were saying in the trial, that they're really proliferating all over the place. And some of the testimony made it seem like just about every other person has one of these, either for hunting or for self-defense or for whatever.
Peter, before we move on, I guess the question is, too, how highly watched is this across the country? Are people paying a lot of attention to see how Illinois' law, if it holds up, is it getting that type of attention?
I think that it is, and the judge did make that point in various comments throughout the trial, saying we all understand how important this case is. We all understand what's at stake here. It is being watched, and it's probably worth noting that if you look at the list of plaintiffs, like I said, there are four cases and each one has multiple plaintiffs within it. But you've got some of the most well-heeled gun rights organizations in the United States. You from the National Sports Shooting Federation. I can't remember the names of all of them. Guns Save Lives. There are a lot of national organizations here that have put money into these cases, hired the lawyers, paid for the expert witnesses, paid for the research. So, you know, within the context of the national debate over gun rights, I think this is really right, sort of at the in the eye of the storm, as it were.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. Well, Charlie, it's been a year since the state did away with cash bail. That was pretty controversial at the time as well. Now there's been a lot of research done. And so far, you know, I can't say that it's worked out perfectly, but it does not seem like the sky has fallen like some people had predicted it would.
No, and that was kind of what the proponents said when the legislation was initially passed. The opponents were concerned that, Darren Bailey running for governor talked about there would be a purge and the jail doors would be thrown open and criminals would be marauding all over town. Well, there was a news conference to highlight a report of preliminary data that the Loyola University researchers found, and they said that the data that they recovered did not show any increase in crime in Illinois since last September, when this law finally took effect. Crime is down in most circumstances. And they also pointed out jail populations are also down. But they cautioned it's still a little early to say that this is the exact conclusions that we're going to reach. We need more information, of course. But they said those who have been granted pretrial release are largely not committing new crimes, according to the data from Cook County. Now, there was a story in St. Louis Public Radio where the St. Clair County chief judge also said the system is working, making the Metro East County safer. He said, and this is a quote, "Those who perhaps were dangerous had the ability to bond out if they had enough money. Many of those people did. They actually got to be on the streets, making our community less safe." He was talking about the system in place before, which proponents of the new change, the Pretrial Fairness Act, noted that in the past, if you had money, you could bail yourself out, even if you were charged with a serious offense. If you didn't have the money, you had to sit in jail. And if you were a poor person and this disproportionately affected people of color, you would be in jail. You'd lose your job. You could maybe cause great problems with your family. And you're just sitting there. And then in the end, you're found not guilty. And it was sort of prejudging that if you're poor, you're guilty. There's no presumption of innocence. If you're rich, you got the money. Well, we'll let you go. You put up the money. And so the data that's available so far makes it seem as this is really working well.
Peter, you've reported on this as well. What stood out to you from the data that's been collected so far?
Well, there were a couple of things, and Charlie mentioned one of them. I've always, in all the time I've been covering state governments, you know, I've heard arguments over various policies saying if you adopt this policy, you're going to destroy the state's economy. Or if we adopt this policy, it's going to solve all of the state's problems in this particular area. More often than not, neither one of those is true. Very little that the state does is going to destroy society or cure all of society's problems. And I think this is an example of it. You get rid of cash bail. It did not empty out the jails. It did not cause a massive increase in crime. But at the same time, there are still people being held in jail pre-trial, regardless of their ability to pay. The one thing that stood out, especially to the researcher, was that prior to this law, about $140 million statewide was being paid out of people's pockets to get bailed out of jail. And that was $140 million, they pointed out, that largely comes out of the pockets of lower income families and poor communities and communities of color. That money is no longer being paid to get people out of jail. And so it's staying in the communities, you know, whether or not, I can't tell you what the economic impact of that is. But the other thing that I, and closely related to that, was the whole theory that, I mean, the purpose of cash bail was to secure somebody's appearance at later court proceedings. The idea was that if you make them put up cash, they will show up to court so that at the end of the process, they'll get their cash back. That whole idea appears to have been fundamentally flawed. Cash does not secure a person's appearance in court, because the failure to appear rate really has been statistically unchanged after the law versus before the law. The same number of people are failing to appear, and it's usually because they forget about the court date, or they don't have transportation, or something else comes up. You know, small problems that can be fixed. But this idea that you have to make people pay money to get them to show up to court has proven to be false, because we're not making them pay money, and people are still showing up to court at about the same rate that they were before.
Is it too soon to say that this is working, though? I mean, it's only been a year, so is there, do the researchers say that they want to see more data, or are they pretty satisfied?
Yes, it is early, and they did say this is preliminary. And one of the reasons for that is that the higher level crimes usually take longer to get to trial. And so, you know, there are a lot of cases out there. Illinois is a big state, Chicago, Cook County are, you know, big cities. There are a lot of people charged with very serious crimes. Those cases have not proceeded all the way through the system yet. And so it's still very early to tell what impact this has overall. It might take as much as, you know, 3, 4, 5 years before we really understand what the difference is. But at least the preliminary data shows that, you know, look out your window today. The world doesn't look a whole lot different than it did before this law went into effect. The only difference is that people no longer have to pay cash to get out of jail while they're awaiting trial.
Okay.
I thought one of the interesting things that the Loyola researchers mentioned, and this is a quote from David Olson, who was one of the researchers, and it goes to what we were saying about the cautious evaluation so far. He says, "We're not saying that the Pretrial Fairness Act reduced crime. We're also not saying that the drop in crime might not have been larger had the law not been in effect. This is at least to put out that crime has not gone up." So they're very cautious. They're not saying that this is going to be some panacea, but they're saying the limited data we have, 1 year's worth of data, and their data came from almost all the counties. It wasn't just Cook County. It was information that they obtained statewide, that all the bad effects that the opponents had contended would occur, none of those have happened so far. And Peter, you were talking about the $140 million. That reminded me of something that I thought at the beginning, when all the, oh gosh, I don't know how many, there was more than 60 states' attorneys filed a lawsuit against this act, which ultimately was upheld by the Illinois Supreme Court. And it occurred to me, all that bail money, well, that's like a cash fund for them. That's like a slush fund for the counties. And particularly in a downstate county, you're going to be hurting. So what do you do? And that's one of the things that still needs to be worked on. And even the people who promoted and passed this act have acknowledged there's got to be more resources made available, particularly outside the metro area, for these downstate counties to be able to hire public defenders, to be able to deal with the additional costs, the additional demands on the courts. Because as you mentioned earlier, the pre-trial hearings, it's not a matter of, okay, Wheeler, the judge saying, okay, Wheeler, you put up $100,000 and you can walk. If not, you're going to jail. Next case. Now they have to actually say, well, is he a threat to anybody, a threat to himself that we should detain him? Or is there some way that we can release him with electronic monitoring? Or is he likely to take off and not come back? So it's a lot more thoughtful a process. It's not just, you know, running them through. And that takes more time. It takes more resources. And so I think there's going to be further push in coming legislative session, next year's budget, to put more money into the funds that are available, particularly the downstate counties, to be able to handle this increased demand for more thoughtful pretrial analysis of people who are charged with offenses as to whether or not should this person be detained or should this person be allowed to go about his business, go back to his job, help provide for his family until it's time for him to come in and actually have a trial.
That's an important point. As part of this law, the state did create, I forget the exact name of it, the Statewide Office of Pretrial Services that pays for smaller counties to operate these pretrial programs like electronic monitoring and other pretrial services. That has now become a permanent financial responsibility of the state going forward. And so it'll be interesting to watch what happens to the cost of that over time.
All right. Well, we go now to our notes from the field, and Charlie, we'll go to you.
All righty. Well, we've been talking about legal issues and court cases so far, so I figured a note from the field along the same lines would be very appropriate. Illinois Supreme Court just the other day, in a 6-0 ruling, said that just the smell of marijuana coming from someone's vehicle isn't enough to justify a warrantless search. And the court found that the cannabis laws in Illinois have evolved to the point that just a sniff of burning weed isn't enough probable cause. And the quote from Justice P. Scott Neville Jr., who wrote for the majority, since January 1st, 2020, the use and possession of cannabis is presumptively lawful, subject to certain restrictions. We hold that the odor of burnt cannabis alone is insufficient to provide probable cause for police officers to perform a warrantless search of a vehicle. The case involved a driver who'd been pulled over on Interstate 80. When he was stopped, he didn't appear to be impaired, and he pulled over immediately. There were no drugs, no smoke or paraphernalia visible inside the car. But the trooper searched the car and found a baggie inside the car's center console. And the court said that the fact that the trooper thought that the driver was traveling in a, quote, known drug corridor was also not enough basis to search his car.
Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.